welcome to our special series, The Town Hall. Our guest today is a celebrated poet, novelist, and even a writer of non-fiction. He's also somebody we've known in India as an outspoken advocate of gay rights and free speech, something that becomes relevant at a time when literature has virtually become the newest battlefield. Most recently, his collection of poems, a new collection of poems, Summer Requiem, has just been published. There's lots to talk to him about, so please let's join our hands together to welcome our guest on the Town Hall today, Vikram Seth. You know, Vikram, I've known you as somebody who is kind of filled with poker-faced humor. Yet when I read the poems in the Summer Requiem, they're so bleak and sad and melancholic and somehow speak to the subliminal sadness that it seems that you've been carrying for many years. I would have thought it was recent, but then I read that these poems have actually been written over a span of time. So they're not triggered by a single incident or a phase in your life, are they?
Poems are born of particular circumstances. When, you know, I'm having a good time with friends and having there's a riotous occasion, I'm not likely to write a poem in those circumstances. So to some extent, poems come to you when you're alone, thinking deeply about some event, sad or otherwise, that may have happened to you. And when you're trying to encapsulate your feelings in such a way that it takes, to some extent, the sting of the sadness away from you. Mm. Now, once I wrote these poems, I thought, okay, that's done, the job is done. Mm. But then, many years later, a friend said to me, look, a poem isn't finished when it's written. Mm. It needs to be shared as well. So sometimes with some reluctance, I felt other people go through sorrows and sadnesses as well. And I think it's ungenerous not to share what came to you as a kind of gift from the muse.
Yet this collection does read as more melancholic than previous poems you've written.
I think that's true.
How do you explain that?
I guess I must have gone through rather bad times. Some of the poems are actually quite early poems. The title poem, Summer Requiem, which is quite a dark and melancholy poem, and a long poem at that, is something that I find quite difficult to understand. For many years, I haven't bothered to publish it, not just because I'm intrinsically quite lazy, but also because, to some extent, I don't understand the poem.
You don't understand what you've written yourself?
Am I allowed to remove sections of this interview?
No.
Ex post facto.
No.
Well, it mystifies me. It goes against my typical principles, which are that you should be able to make sense of what's written. Mm-hmm. Whether it's in rhyme and meter or whether it's written as prose, it should be pretty clear and plain what the thing means. It can have its own resonances, but...
But the mind is a lost country, for example.
Yes.
That is easy to... I mean, it's not easy to understand, but that is... People will perhaps take away their own interpretations, but everybody's like that at some point.
The mind is a lost country. That's one of my lines, right, Balka?
Yeah, I'm not trying to steal them. I'm pushing it back to you.
No, but I'm asking you to explain it to me.
That you feel lost in your mind, which has multiple geographies and realities and...
God, Balka, you should take over my role. That's very good. Okay, so at some stage, not now, obviously, this would be very boring, but at some stage you should take me aside and explain the poem Summer Requiem to me. I feel it's a good poem. If I didn't feel it was a good poem, I would not put it out under my name, but I am still somewhat mystified by it. Similarly, there are other poems which are very clear. I look at them and I think, was I really in such a pit, in such a vortex of darkness, as seems to be evident from that poem? For example, the poem Caged, about two people lying next to each other, absolutely lost to each other with bitterness and resentment, and just hoping that their love too can disappear. The wretched fact is that the love continues despite the misery of being virtually bound together. Mm.
Many of the poems do read like either love gone wrong or love lost. And a lot of people have therefore read into these poems your own personal experience of losing your long-standing relationship with the violinist Philippe Honoré. Is that true? How much of that impacted this writing?
I don't want to make it too explicitly biographical, but yes, there was some of that in it. The fact is, we are very, very good friends, again, let's say, after a period. I mean, we are not together in any standard sense. I'm not with anyone as such. But I feel that a long-standing relationship, if it is possible to avoid this, should not be done away with. You're doing away with a large chunk of your own life, a decade or more, and as much time of his or her life.
You said that the poems have been written over many years. So how many years would that be?
Well, I would say, although I haven't written published a book of poems for, I imagine, 20 years or something.
All you who sleep tonight.
When was all of you? I don't remember when it was written.
Yeah.
But certainly a long time. Some poems, like Summer Requiem, go back even further. And not only do they go back, but I keep tinkering with them, even though I don't quite understand what they are. Well, take another poem which I love, for example, by, say, Coleridge. Not, you know, to mention great poetry compared to lesser poetry. There again, someone explained to me what Kubla Khan is about. I don't know what it's about. It goes against my general tenets of poetry, which is that it should make sense. It should move. It should intrigue. But it should at least make sense.
So when did this start happening that you couldn't understand your own poetry?
If you could get me a couch, Barkha, and lie on it, and we can go into it. The fact is, I've looked at some of my poetry, and I just said, look, this is bad poetry. I'm a bit embarrassed by it. I can't, it's sort of callow and juvenile or too self-indulgent or whatever. So that is out. And I didn't understand how I could have written such awful stuff. But something like this, which I can't quite get the hang of, although I think it's good, it's possible at any rate. But what it says, it conveys a mood.
Pretty much they all convey the same mood. There's a bleakness
to
them.
No, that's not true.
There's a bleakness running through the collection.
Running through the collection, but there are lighter poems in it as well.
Yeah,
but this is a dark.
But you just seem like a funny guy.
Yeah. Well, they say, of course, that the clown. Well, actually, I am. I mean, the fact of the matter is, life doesn't cease to be a tragedy because people laugh.
Yeah.
And life doesn't cease to be a comedy because people die.
Yeah.
And thank you. I'll take the applause vicariously because the thought is not original with me. But I'll certainly accept that. That's someone else. Who it was, I can't remember. But writers filch. And occasionally they admit that they filch. Sometimes they don't. But I think that is my general view of life. And actually that is why I think that it really behooves us to think in these and other times about how difficult life is, not only for ourselves when we're looking at our own navels, but also for other people in the world. If someone who comes from such a privileged background educationally and otherwise, as I do, can go through periods of darkness, when you consider what life is like for most people in our country, or really in the world for that matter, are we even allowed to have moods such as these and express them self-indulgently? My answer is yes, we are, but we can't then forget about other people.
Okay, so on that note, I'm going to open this up to our young audience here. I'm sure a lot of them have questions. Vikram, as you know, right now, history used to be the battlefield in India. Right now, it's literature. And I know that a lot of people may have questions on that along with literature. So let me take
first. I will also say that history and literature are both battlefields in India.
They are both. They are both together. Battlefields. Yuvanika?
My question is that, since you've gotten a lot of accolades yourself, but there's also been a recent spate of Indian authors who've given back their awards, like, for example, the Sahitya Academy Awards, in a sort of protest against the BJP governance. So as a recipient
also
of the Sahitya...
Also a protest against the Sahitya Academy itself.
Yeah. But, as a recipient of the Sahitya Academy Award yourself for Golden Gate, would you ever consider giving back an award?
For me, really, awards are really, they don't carry much personal weight with me. Getting an award will not improve your writing by even a semicolon. Getting an award, no matter how august that award might be, usually given by a committee. Some people have one opinion, others have another, things are decided by majority votes. For me, the real award is someone saying, look, my tea is getting cold, but I don't care, I'm reading this book. Or they missed their metro stop. Because actually this has happened to me. Someone wrote to me and that they missed their a book of translations of Chinese poets that I'd written, and they got a letter sent to me through my publisher saying we're very annoyed with you that we missed three or four stops, you know, on the London Underground. So those are awards. Those are the real satisfaction. That is why, instead of saying being an economist or a demographer, I'm a writer and happy to be one. And, you know, that is what gives me pleasure. Now, the Golden Gate and the Sahitya Academy Award, I don't know when I got it. It must have been 1986 or 80, something like 88. And it was given by other people in the Sahitya Academy who were then, you know, the people who ran it and so on. Sahitya Academy is an institution, a great institution, you know, founded partly by first people, including Nehru, Radhakrishnan, great literatures and scholars, as well as, you know, statesmen. I don't think the Sahitya Academy has covered itself with glory by the recent actions, you know, when you consider what happened to Kulbergi and also to the Volcker and Pansare and so on. There doesn't seem to have been any expression except the most mealy-mouthed generalization about, oh, it's a sad sort of thing that's happening. But nothing about the protection of free speech, nothing about the protection of the life, for that matter, of a writer, no indignant remark, nothing about how disgusting and terrible this sort of thing is. So I would say that what many writers, starting from, I guess, Uday Prakash and then Nayantara and so on, have, I think it required a lot of courage to give back something that is basically an accolade, which you accepted with grace, and then the question is it a disgrace or is it ungracious to give back an award? I don't think so in this case. I think it's not necessarily a protest against the government at large, though there may be elements about that, of that. It is basically, you are an organization that is supposed to protect free speech. You're supposed to protect writers. And not a word of indignation, not a word of protest about this. They have brought forward their meeting from, I think, December to the 23rd of October.
Yeah.
I would like to see what comes out of that meeting.
And then decide?
And then decide. They would never have done it had it not been for the writers who gave up their awards. But now it behooves us, who have not yet given it up, to take our own view on the matter. And I, for my part, would like to see what emerges from it. And if, in fact, nothing emerges from it except the same kind of
generalization,
I will make up my mind, which is a way of saying what you imagine I am saying.
So you're saying that at the moment you haven't returned
the
award because...
I haven't.
At one level, the award is a bit meaningless to you. Is that?
It's not that. It's just that the effectiveness of returning an award, in a sense, has already had its effect. It's made them concentrate on calling a meeting forward by 2 months to decide what to do. So it is a bit counterproductive at the moment for me to also give up my award. What I would like them to do is to change their behavior.
So you're going to say how the Sahitya Academy reacts on the assassination of Kalburgi, whether it's going to be more strong and more robust in its intervention, and if that disappoints you, then you will consider also returning the honor.
Exactly.
Is that a
yes,
fair summary?
Absolutely. I think that I've really been shaken by this, and I'm very admiring of the other writers. But at the moment, the most effective thing would be to make sure that they change their stance. That's the main thing to make sure of.
Okay.
In a sense, I would have shot my bolt otherwise, you know, if I'd given up my award or if I give up my award before the meeting. But after the meeting, all bets are off as far as I'm concerned.
Next question, Chirag.
Rationalists were killed under the Congress regime.
Yeah.
And bans on books and movies, for example, Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses. Communal rights like those in Delhi in 1984 have also taken place before the BJP came to power.
True.
Bans and censorship has been imposed during successive governments.
Yeah.
So is your point why are the awards being returned now?
The question that comes is like, why is it that only now the authors have decided to protest against growing intolerance and threat to freedom of speech and expression?
Basically, jaise ki kehte hain, ye roshni ke saath kyun dhuaa utha chiraag se. To chiraag, isme aapne kuch dhuaa sa mila liya hai. I just made it very clear that I am not protesting directly
against the
BJP government. Yeah. Certainly, as a citizen of this country, I have objected against things in the past, including the Babri Masjid when it was broken down. You know, there was a BJP government in the state, but there was a non-BJP government in the center then. It was a Congress
government. Narasimha Rao was the Prime Minister of the Babri Masjid.
Exactly. I have protested directly about certain events, whether it was Tiananmen or Steve Biko or the Babri Masjid and so on. I'm not a general activist, but when I speak out, I do speak out about these matters. However, this particular thing should not be muddied by saying, oh, this happened in 1984, why didn't you give it up in 1986 and so on, why do you accept it in 1988? Mm. This is specifically about the Sahitya Academy. The fact is that this award is a literary award, and we're talking about a literary institution, I would say, whose mission it would be partly to protect free speech.
May I just now add a question? That, you know, I think that what's happened is that the anger with the Sahitya Academy has, in the case of some writers, got clubbed with a general ideological disillusionment with the BJP. And that's why even the BJP, Arun Jaitley wrote a long essay on his Facebook page. That's he actually said that this is ideological intolerance. I'm just quoting what he said. Yeah. He said this is ideological intolerance. Many of these writers had the patronage of previous governments. Now the Congress is nowhere. The left is nowhere. This is politics by other means. I'm just quoting
that. This tutu meme stuff will get us nowhere. To solve the real problems of this country rather than to throw resentments at each other. Obviously, I'm deeply disturbed by what's happening in this country, the atmosphere of hate that is sought to be inculcated against people of other religions, non-Hindus, whether it's Christians or Muslims or whatever. I'm deeply troubled by the fate of the tribals, who are the original people of this country, the Adi Vasis, who are now sought to be encompassed by either, you know, Hindu evangelists or Christian evangelists or whatever. We should just learn, for heaven's sake, to just be reasonable. I'm not even saying be tolerant, be reasonable towards each other. But this particular thing about this award is specific to the Sahitya Academy.
Why has it become perceived as a protest, a mass protest against Narendra Modi? For you, it's not that.
No, I'm not saying, I mean, in this particular case, yes, I feel what's happened is some institutions have been undermined by... that would not have been enough. That would, for me to think of giving back my award or to applaud those people who have shown courage, no matter whether their thoughts were also affected by other political matters. After all, we're a seamless continuum. Free speech has a lot to do with politics, doesn't it?
Yes.
So the two are tied together. Literature has a lot to do with history.
Yes.
If you're not allowed to, for example, publish a book, if you're a scholar of Hinduism and you're not allowed to publish a book...
Wendy Doniger.
Correct. And... again, in times of Salman Rushdie, I have protested about the fact that his books were not allowed free rein. I spoke about it very, very plainly.
I remember that.
So, I think we are both citizens and readers, and in my case, perhaps you'd say professional as a writer. So, the motives for our actions sometimes are quite complex. And it's very difficult to say, you did it because of this. Now, take Arun Jaitley, for example.
Yeah.
He did speak out about this dreadful, dreadful business. He was one of the first people to speak out about what happened in Dadri.
Yes.
He also, despite the fact that the BJP in general, of all the parties, the BJP seems to be the most in favor of this foreign law that was brought in 1860 against...
377.
377.
Decriminalizing homosexuality. He was the only one. Who actually said it should be decriminalized. Yes.
Now, he's also a politician. He also has his own views. He may also take the point of view that many of these protests are politically...
Yeah.
He's free to make his point. No one should go to his door and shoot him.
Of course.
No one should come to my door and shoot me. No one should blacken your face, Barkha.
Yeah. I'll tell you why the political questions persist, and it's not just tutu meme. When we started this conversation, we spoke about both history and literature having become battlefields.
Yeah.
And they have very much in today's India.
True.
It almost feels like, you know, in the United States of America, there was this time when this kind of conflict between the right and the left was described as culture wars. And this is a kind of culture wars that we are seeing, where there is a kind of battle for the intellectual space, so to speak. I mean, I don't mean to make it more lofty than it is, but the reason the BJP is also reacting to this spate of returned honours is because they don't see it as being just about the Sahitya Academy. They see it as them being singled out. They say Dadri happened under a Samajwadi Party government, Kalburgi happened under a Congress government. And so you have writers forced in a way to take political positions.
Look, elections are coming up, right?
Yeah.
let's not be unrealistic about this.
Yeah.
If someone says, bhai, tum gai ke hatyare ke saath ho ya gai ke rakshak ke saath ho, you know, to get some part of the Yadav vote, if they try to do this sort of thing, if the people who actually brought the crowd to the house of Akhlaq.
Yes.
The father of Muhammad Sartaj. And yes. I've never actually seen you, who are so articulate, so much at a loss for words, than that young man who in a measured way described what he thought even now. Mazhab nahi sikhata aapas mein, sare jahan se, hum bulbul hai uski. If there is something that this fighting for space, this clash of civilizations, is something that is foreign, I would say, both to the better ethos of India, and I would say, if one has to talk about it, even the better ethos of Hinduism, my religion and yours. This idea that civilizations must clash, I mean, the greatest thing that people should learn, if they have to learn something from India, is not the invention of the zero, or yoga, or IT. It's just how to get on with each other.
Yeah.
How to live with each other.
Yeah.
This is something our most precious psychological resource, the thing that makes us who we are, that we are in great danger of losing. I have Christian friends who feel less at home in their own country. I have Muslim friends who feel threatened. You and I, Barkha, belong to the majority religion, as it's euphemistically called. But if I were a Muslim, would I be any less worthy of being a citizen of India? I feel that a leader who demeans another Indian because of the food he eats, because of the God he prays to, because of the person he loves, is not worthy to be an Indian leader.
All right, let's take it back to the floor. Noor, we spoke a little bit about 377, and I know you feel strongly about it. Let's get her a mic.
I'm in danger of losing my sense of humor. When I think of these things, you know.
No, we have to still be able to laugh. Yeah. We have to.
I think the sense of humor is the most important thing. I think it will get us through the worst right now. Yeah. I don't know how to phrase this, but with 377, it's still there. It's 2013, December, the verdict came, the court refuses to hear. The Supreme Court was supposed to hear the plea again, they refused to. The government's never going to speak up. I think we all know it, because they'll lose too many votes. As a writer, as a Sahitya Kala Academy Award recipient, as well as a Padma Bhushan recipient, and
Padmashree,
I'm sorry. Do you not feel that somewhere writers, the intellectuals of this country also need to come out and start speaking on issues? You have spoken, but others also need to come out and start speaking on issues of human rights. Because 377 is a violation of human rights. It's basic, basic human
Absolutely.
Rights.
In fact, one of the two judges in the Supreme Court who reversed the decision of the Delhi High Court said, oh, well, it doesn't matter. There are too few of them.
Mm. It's a
minuscule minority. Saying that the Parsis can be pushed into the sea because there are only however many tens of thousands of them. I mean, when it's a matter of fundamental rights, as my mother said, it is a case of judicial pusillanimity, of cowardice, basically, let alone judicial misinterpretation. Shove it over to the politicians, who, of course, could have done something in Congress times.
But did
now
not
can't.
For 10 years also.
Well, indeed,
the Congress did
indeed,
nothing for 10 years.
Nobody did anything.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court has agreed. I think they got such a lot of institutional criticism that they did something unusual, which was to say that they would agree to hear, sorry to get technical, guys, a curative petition, which is a petition heard before a bench of five
they
judges.
They still haven't heard it. It's court. Been a year
now,
and a
part
half.
Of the reason, I think, is they waited for the other two to retire, because they would have had to become members of those. Now, who's going to say, I'm sorry, I was wrong? So that's part of the reason. The first guy wrote his rather idiotic judgment, and off he went into the sunset. The other guy hung on for a couple of years. And I won't honor them by taking their names. But he's now retired, I think. Let's see what happens. The arc of injustice has run on long enough. Let's see whether the arc of justice takes over. All I can say is, I mean, I've spoken out about it, even though I didn't think it would particularly change the law immediately or whatever, because it is crucial that people who don't live in a more liberal milieu like you and I do, but are in some small kasba town or in a village, who are being bullied by their peers or by their parents, or think, you know, what are these feelings I'm having? Am I who might commit suicide or live miserable lives?
Be collectively raped.
Be collectively raped. Can you imagine something was said by one of these babas? I can't remember
that.
I feel sometimes that all these intolerant people from whatever religion they come, should be taken to an island and made to live together. They'll get along very well.
Yeah, they will. They all will.
I'll tell you something very interesting. Of course, one shouldn't compare them with, you know, war criminals, but something quite interesting happened with, I think, in The Hague, when they got all these guys, the Croats, the Serbs, and the Bosnians together, who had been imprisoned. They were imprisoned in the same place, and they got along extremely well.
But you know,
ये जैसे कि क्या मानसिकता की बात है. It's a kind of mindset of these.
सोच ही खराब है.
Vikram, you had said at that time, the day the judgment came, I remember interviewing you, yeah. Or maybe one day after,
yeah.
And you said, I wasn't a criminal when I came here,
yeah.
But I'm going to wake up a criminal the next morning. Now, I'm just wondering, when you come here as somebody who has sort of, you know, publicly positioned yourself as a bisexual, do you believe that it's different today because it's not decriminalized? Is it different? Is life different? Is your sense of identity different?
Sure. I mean, I even someone like me, who is always, you know, despite the blandishments of you know, other nations, I've always remained an Indian. I feel, you know, why should I be a criminal in my own country? But in my case, okay, I've long ago not only come to terms with it, I've embraced whoever I happen to be. But there are so many people who are being pressured by their families, whom the police is
harassing.
And who live lives of quiet desperation. So yes, it does make a difference. Maybe not necessarily in the metros, but it does make a difference in the world in general, I think. That's my take on it. I'm not sure.
And I mean, I sometimes I put things to polls. I don't even need to put this to a poll. This is India's young.
Yeah.
And how many of you think 377 belongs to 100 years ago? Raise your hand. And that's pretty much the whole room.
Maybe I should stand.
You should stand.
I know, not just stand out of thanks, but stand as a candidate. I should, or maybe a Khas Aadmi Party.
All right, Nishtha, where are you?
Sir, John Steinbeck once famously said, "I hold that a writer that does not passionately believe in the perfectibility of man has no devotion or membership in literature." So in the current scenario where our elected readers and even societal mechanisms are failing the basic norms of humanity, how are we then as students of literature and as young writers to believe in the perfectibility of man when we see an increase in his fallacies?
I think it's a heavy burden that Steinbeck has laid upon his colleagues, alive or dead. I don't think it's my duty as a writer to believe that things are going to go better or going to get worse. I've never really believed that man is perfectible. But let me say one thing about, in the context that we've been talking. The public use of religion is something very interesting. Because ordinarily, to generalize, good people do good things and bad people do bad things, or vaguely. But to make good people do bad things, bring out religion, whip up religion, and you can make good people do bad things. You can make them more imperfect than they are. So to that extent, I would say, if you want to improve the lot, not just in India, but in the world in general, please take religion out of the public space.
Yeah.
I was brought up, I mean, I've just translated the Hanuman Chalisa. It's a work I love. But a Christian friend of mine might get pleasure and solace out of a Christian hymn. A Muslim friend of mine might read the Fatiha or get some other ayat of the Quran or some other surah. By what right does he have to tell me that I can't do what I do, or I have to tell him that he can't do what he likes to do? By what right? Mazhab se zyada, jab mazhab aur insaniyat ka takkar hota hai, there is no question in my mind that humanity must trump religion. Whatever it is, humanity and human rights should be much more important than religion. Religion is a private space and should remain so.
Would you then support a uniform civil code?
Barka, the problem with many of these things is, what circumstances are they brought under? For example, there was a law in Christianity. Men could divorce on the grounds of, I think, women could...
On adultery,
but women had to have adultery plus cruelty, or adultery plus something else. And eventually these laws was seen as so unjust, they were changed, but at the instigation of
the community
the community itself. If a change in this law, which I think in general terms is desirable, we should get rid of special Hindu clauses like the Hindu...
All personal laws are anti-women to start with. Well, all personal
absolutely.
Laws of all faiths militate against correct. Equality
the
of
karta
women.
In a Hindu undivided family, yeah. though it's changed in certain states, so is a man. Well, whatever it is in this particular case, it is something to be aspired to as the Constitution wishes. But it is not something that can be forced down people's throats by an antagonistic group of people. Despite that, however, I would say that something like the Shah Bano business, that was an utter disgrace.
Yeah.
A person who had such a strong mandate as Rajiv Gandhi had yeah. to go with the most reactionary forces to acquiesce in this change of law. Again, I say that no matter which religion it is, the rights of equal citizens, no matter their gender, to equality under the law should be and must be supreme.
Gilda?
So my question is, your works are a mix of fiction and your experiences and sort of thing, majorly your experiences and your stances. So
majorly my experiences and my stances?
Maybe.
Okay,
yeah. So if there is a pure choice for you between a pure fiction and experienced stuff, what would you choose to write on?
I think what you're saying basically is fiction, which is invented storytelling.
Yes.
And
Derived from an actual experience.
An actual experience. Yeah. In different moods. You could call me a biliterary person, if you will. In the mood to do so, a triliterary person, whatever that means. If I'm inspired to do something, if I'm inspired to write a poem, whether it's a short poem like All You Who Sleep Tonight, or a long poem like The Golden Gate, which is both a long poem and a novel, I don't argue with the muse. I don't say, you know, you've come to me asking me to write a travel book, but what I'd rather write today is a poem because that's how I see myself. No, I take any inspiration as being a gift, and I try to work with it.
Okay, Nikunj?
So you spoke about cultural identity and how you value yourself as an Indian eventually. They say a man's identity is hidden away in his language. And a lot of people argue that as Indians, our primary language should be Sanskrit. And a lot of politics...
Primary language or one of the languages?
A lot of people argue that as Indians, it is our duty to maintain this language. Okay. Because it is where our cultural identity lies. That is where all our texts are written in. And a lot of politics has been mixed in this. What do you think?
What are the religions that have actually been born in India? All the tribal religions, as I said, the Adi, Vasi, that's even more ancient than Sanskrit. Okay, Buddhism was born here, Jainism was born here, Sikhism was born here, right? What religions came from outside? The Parsi religion came from outside, the Hindu religion came from outside, the Christian religion came from outside, Islam came from outside. People who, Hindu religion, the reason why Sanskrit, Greek and Latin have so many common roots is because they had a common ancestry, supposedly somewhere in Central Asia. So for us who belong to that religion, to tell the latecomers, hum toh yahan bas gaye hain, as far as you're concerned, you know, you're from somewhere else. These books that we treasure, you know, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, the Bhagavad Gita, the Puran, the Veds, etc. These are fine. Or later still, you know, the Hanuman Chalisa, whatever, are fine. But these other things are not so central to the idea of being an Indian. I say to that, what is this nonsense? This came from outside. I mean, what are you telling us? We're happy. I'm happy in my religion. You just keep calm and be happy in your religion as well. Don't thrust things down my throat. If I want to learn Sanskrit, I shall learn Sanskrit. Yeah. If I want to learn Urdu, I learn Urdu. If for that matter I want to learn German, I learn German.
How many languages do you know?
I really only know two. The others I always find myself translating.
Mandarin?
No, I'm talking about Hindi and English.
Well, I mean one keeps reading that you're a polyglot,
right? I lived in China for 2 years. Yeah. Why? China is the enemy country. Why are you studying China, the Chinese culture zone is part of humanity. It's a great culture zone. Some of the greatest poets I've lived in China, and I was so moved by some poetry that I'd read in translation that I decided I'd learn the language. Then I lived in China for 2 years, somehow twisting my economics dissertation in such a way that I got permission to go there, and I learned Chinese calligraphy, but I've also learned Arabic calligraphy. Yeah. And so this is the great benefit of India, in a sense, that we've never turned our eyes away from knowledge, from insight, from philosophy, no matter where it's come from. You're deliberately impoverishing yourself. Guys, wise up.
Yeah.
That's what I want to say.
Agreed.
I mean, I have Chinese friends, and because I belong to at least that kind of economic class which can go abroad and find that they're not some kind of shaitan hua, and they can find that I'm not. Similarly, who here has Pakistani friends? Only those people, on the whole, who have either had the chance to go abroad and live abroad.
Yeah.
Now, why should someone who's a chaiwala not have a chaiwala Pakistani friend?
Well, to start with, you could get ink on your face.
Indeed.
Vidushi, your question.
That relates to my question, actually. So, as a free thinker and blogger myself,
yes,
the recent incidents of painting Mr. Kulkarni's face, or killing of rationalists in India, or for that matter, killing of the Bangladeshi bloggers,
yes,
limits and curbs my own freedom of expression. So, I'd say the pen is no more mightier than the sword now. So, does it affect you as a seasoned and liberal writer? Also, post the Charlie Hebdo attacks, although the killing is not justified, but people did limit themselves in the sense that to how far can they actually mock people's belief?
Remember that, you know, we are writers with some sense, not only partly of mission, but also we want to write whatever we're inspired to write. But yes, it does have a curbing effect. I remember when I was writing A Suitable Boy, some people were quite close to me. I won't mention them. They said, Vikram, why are you writing all about this religious stuff? You know, the shivling being brought up. Why are you talking about these religious riots and putting such graphic remarks in people's mouths? I said, how can you write about Indian reality without writing about these things? They're not there to incite people, but they're there to show the reality such as it is. I have no doubt that when A Suitable Girl comes out, people will snip it out and all the creepy crawlies will come out of the crevices of the internet, as they have with Amitabh, as they had with Amartya Sen, as they have with Anantamurthy.
Do you self-censor?
I don't actually, but I can see the danger of it. I consciously try not to self-censor.
But, you know,
but I shouldn't have to consciously try to do that.
But in the aftermath of the Charlie Hebdo attacks,
I didn't quite answer that.
I was going to say that even writers were divided to the extent that I remember this whole controversy with Penn and the awards, and a number of writers extricated themselves and said, while we condemn the terror attack, we don't support what the magazine did. So even writers are not totally agreed on absolute free speech.
Well, I agree with that too. I think that if you're, you know, I'm not saying there should be no curbs on free speech.
Hmm.
If free speech consists of inciting people to violence, if it actually consists of saying, go out and kill your neighbor, well, that speech, free speech, has to be curbed. Also, different people have different views on how far one can go. After all, we are writers, but we're also citizens.
Yes.
I think each person must make their own either impulsive or mature mind up about these
matters. Were you comfortable with the cartoons?
I don't think any one religion can claim the right to such a sense of hurt that nothing critical can be said about them. I think that should be true of Hinduism, it should be true of Christianity, it should be true of Islam, it should be true of any religion. The thing to do is to turn your face away. Boycott that book if you like, but do not prevent other people from reading it. I'm generalizing as a way of answering your question.
Okay, let's take the next question. Kajari?
Sir, you certainly are a very versatile poet, right? So, your poems like The Frog and the Nightingale and The Tale of Melon City are some of our childhood favorites.
Right.
And with your latest collection of verse, The Summer Requiem, you have catered to a much more mature crowd of people. So, I would like to ask you how you grasp the psychology of such a diverse group of readers.
Well, I don't try to cater. I try to write what I'm inspired to write at any given time. In the case of Beastly Tales, I don't even know how the first poem began. It was that it was extremely hot, and we lived in a house in Delhi which had the roof tarred black. So that, of course, made it even hotter than it was, and the electricity had failed. So I went to the house of a friend who happened to have a generator 3 or 4 doors down, and I was writing a suitable boy at that time, but I don't know quite how, began thinking of a cool river and mangoes and sitting by the side of the Ganga. And then I thought, of course, there's this famous story, I think originally a Jatak tale or from the Panchtantra, about the monkey and the crocodile. So that's how the first came up. I gave a twist to each of these, whether it's the Aesop's fable about the hare and the tortoise. I had a lot of fun writing them. Then the two at the end about the frog and the nightingale. That's quite a serious poem about artistic freedom,
yeah,
and trying to be yourself. And then what you could call a very long ecological fable called The Elephant and the Tragopan, which was based upon my brother's experience about the problems in the Dzuku Valley in the northeast. That's how those things came about. As far as these poems and other poems are concerned, again, I'm a creature, so to speak, of my mood and of my time
and also
of my times.
Does that mood also involve waking up and first playing Candy Crush before you do anything else? I discovered this recently. I was quite fascinated.
Candy Crush. Huh? Do you like Candy Crush?
I don't play it.
You don't play Candy Crush. You're missing out on the best that life has to offer. But I sometimes don't get out of bed. Sometimes I can't get out of bed. I feel...
That might be the perfect cue to read Kant.
Kant.
Talking about
it's a short poem,
yeah,
and it's in the form of a villanelle. A villanelle is a form where two lines keep repeating themselves, and there are only two rhymes in the whole poem. Can't. I find I simply can't get out of bed. I shiver and procrastinate and stare. I'll press the reset button in my head. I hate my work, but I'm in the red. I'd quit it all if I could live on air. I find I simply can't get out of bed. My joints have rusted and my brain is lead. I drank too much last night, but now I swear I'll press that reset button in my head. My love has gone. What do I have instead? Hot water bottle, God, and teddy bear. I find I simply can't get out of bed. The dreams I dreamt have filled my soul with dread. The world is mad. There's darkness everywhere. I'll press the reset button in my head. Who'll kiss my tears away or earn my bread? Who'll reach the clothes hung on that distant chair? I simply must get out of bed and press that reset button in my head.
And do you now get out of bed?
Majburan.
All right, last question. Ravi Jotwani.
Sir, the adjective suitable has been stalking you for a while. Do you ever get tired on answering questions about a suitable boy? And is it easier or difficult to write a sequel on a book particularly as big as A Suitable Boy? And I've read somewhere that Tintin is your favorite. Who is your favorite, actually?
Well, I love Tintin. And when I learned foreign language, when I was learning French, I did it by looking at the original Tintins, which were written by a Belgian. Now, of course, you find Tintin in Chinese and Bengali. In China, he's Ding Ding and others. And Thompson and Thompson, originally Dupont et Dupont, with a T and with a D. The previous question, I'm trying to work backwards.
Sequel to Suitable Boy, and how tough is that?
Quite tough. It's been a long time coming, but then on the other hand, what I did was I set the sequel 60 years later in the present.
So you have 60 more years to do it?
Not quite. But since what I wrote about an 18-month period took me 7 years to write, I don't think I'd ever have caught up with myself if I'd continued that way. So anyway, I'm working. As you say, I'm still... she will arrive at her...
Suitable girl.
Yeah, suitable. Okay. As far as suitability is concerned, for some reason, the picture that they took here, I don't look at all like a writer. I've got a suit and a tie. And the reason why that happened was because that morning, the chap who came to take a picture for the 377 thing in India Today, he saw me completely... I'd forgotten he was going to come to take a picture. And I said, give me time to shave. He said, no, wait, this is exactly what I want.
Yeah.
And he took that picture. So in order to somehow behlaw my parents, I was going to have lunch with the Hindu. I said, look, I'll get them to take very smart pictures of me. And so I dressed up in a jacket and tie, and that's what I did. Okay. Very suitably attired.
Okay, we're going to close now with another of your poems.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Barkha wants me to read No Further War, which is quite a dark poem.
It is very dark.
Perhaps this is the darker side of my belief at one time, that people could not come together, or even if they could, what with the ease of the use of weaponry, with non-state actors and even with countries, the fact that now something as large as, soon as large as my teacup or that bottle there can destroy a city.
Yeah.
Every century has produced its nutcases as leaders. Every century has produced its very wise and statesman-like people. Our century won't be any different, except now they have the means to finish us all off. No further war. We are the last generations. Surdas, Bach, Rembrandt, Dufu, all life, love, work and worth will end in the particular reign. No ark will screen its force, no prayer procure rebirth. The government of nations is assigned sage, journeyman, and lunatic by rota. A couple of toxic madmen sting mankind each century. We won't escape the quota. Dead planet of an unimportant star, beautiful earth, whose radiant creation became too radiant. No further war, no suffering, frenzy, or recrimination will litter your denatured crust or mar your deepening entropy with agitation.
A grim note to end on.
Yes.
A grim note to end on. But
why not?
But why not? Thank you, Vikram. It has been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Barkha.
Thank you. Let's have a big round of applause for Vikram.